1 Corinthians 11:17 and the following verses, titled Situation in Corinth Review, the 32nd talk in a series in 1 Corinthians, was presented by Ron Julian on May 23, 2004 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2004. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Good morning. I think it was 2 years ago, it was over 2 years ago, that I first started this series in 1 Corinthians, and it's been months and months since I was last up here talking about it, so I'm sure you all remember everything I said. I know we have a few visitors, though, so just for their sake, I might just briefly review. Paul, in the two letters to the Corinthians, is writing to a troubled church. He was there and founded the church originally. He lived there in Corinth for a year and a half, working with developing the church there. Now he is gone, and he has heard of a number of problems that have emerged in the church. They have written him asking him about some of those problems, others of the problems he has heard from people from the church who have come to visit him. And so he's writing in response to very specific issues and specific problems that they have. I just want to remind you what I think are some important answers to a few key questions about the letter. I think this is important to have in mind as we go into the letter. First of all, what is Paul's attitude toward the people in this church? How does he see them as a group? And I think it's important for us to understand as we look at the letter that he sees it as a mixture of genuine believers and those whose faith is questionable. There's a lot of debate about books like Corinthians. When Paul makes a certain comment, is he saying that you have to do that because it is essential for your salvation, or no, he's writing to Christians, they're all Christians, and so he's just encouraging them to do a little better in their Christian walk, or what's at stake in the commands and exhortations that he's giving them? Well, I think we have to remember that some of the people in Corinth are so worldly in their perspective, as we see the evidence in the letter, that they reject Paul as an apostle. They think his gospel is sort of embarrassing, and they're looking for something that is more attractive from a worldly perspective, that the world around them would see as wise. So Paul has real enemies in this church, those who actually have set themselves up as leaders against him. So at times he talks to the church as if he's talking to genuine believers, because in fact he is, because he's quite aware and believes that there are people in the church who are committed to the gospel and have personally embraced it. And at times he speaks as if they're not believers at all, because he also knows that there are those in the church who, if you look at the way they're living right now, their attitude is so fundamentally anti-gospel and worldly that it's hard to know how you could even call them believers at all. So we find Paul saying, on the one hand, you know, God's doing this great thing among you, and on the other hand, you need to examine yourself and figure out if you're a believer at all. And those two things are happening in the same letters because he's writing to a mixed group with a variety of attitudes and problems. Now, the other question that I want to ask and answer, and this is a very important thing for us to keep in mind, is when we come to a letter like this, we have to ask the question, how do we apply it to ourselves? I mean, what does this letter have to do with me? Because Paul is speaking to particular problems in the Corinthian church. He's speaking to the problem that there are divisions in the group. He's speaking to a problem where a particular member in the group is involved in sexual immorality. He's speaking to the issue that there seems to be a group in the church who are married but believe that they are too holy to have sexual relationships with their spouse. He's speaking to a disagreement about whether it is okay to eat meat sacrificed to idols. And in the passage today, what we're going to see is that there are problems and divisions that have arisen regarding the Lord's Supper. So, what if I don't have those particular problems? What if I'm married and I think it's okay to have sexual relations with my spouse? So, I guess Paul's letter on that topic is not particularly relevant to me. Or what if I don't even have meat around that's sacrificed to idols, so I don't have to worry about whether I'm going to eat it or not? So is that another part of the letter that's not relevant to me? In particular, we're going to be talking about the Lord's Supper. In this particular group, right now, we do that once a year. And we call it 100% increase from what we used to do? Okay, so once a year, I don't see when we do it that we have the problem that is described here. So is this another part of the letter that's not particularly relevant to us? And I would argue no, that's not the case for any of these things, because the Bible is not just a set of rules that says, okay, if you get in this situation and you're doing the Lord's Supper, then you're supposed to do X, Y, and Z. And so we can look and say, okay, well, we do X, Y, and Z, so I guess we're okay. Rather, Paul, in this letter, is seeing a problem, but he's seeing behind that a perspective on life, an attitude that is profoundly at odds with the gospel that the Corinthians supposedly have embraced. So he's speaking into the particular situation out of a set of beliefs, out of a perspective on the world. He sees reality a certain way because as an apostle, he has been instructed in the truth of the gospel and he sees life correctly. And he thinks that some in Corinth are not seeing things correctly. So out of that perspective, he tells them, here's the problem, here's what I think you ought to do. What we need to do is try to understand what is that perspective that he has. What is his worldview? What are the truths and principles out of which he is speaking? Take those truths and principles, build them into our own view of life, and then we can take those truths and principles and apply them in a variety of areas. I would say that the issues involved with the Lord's Supper in this passage actually, in some ways, are not particularly restricted just to the Lord's Supper, that the issues cut deeply in a lot of different ways. And if we understand what's at stake, then ultimately we can see what the relevance of this is to us. So I think that's important for us to understand. At least it's going to be important for you to understand what I'm doing when I'm looking at this. Fundamentally, when I'm done with this section about the Lord's Supper, primarily I'm not going to be encouraging us to do the Lord's Supper in a certain way, even though that seems to be the topic that Paul's talking about here, because I think the issues involved are broader and apply to a lot of different things. And that's the same thing that we have found as we have gone along. Yes, there are divisions in Corinth, but the issues underneath that are bigger than just getting along with each other. Yes, there was some debate about the role of sexuality in the life of a godly person, but the issues there went deeper than just the particulars of my relationship with my spouse. That time and time again we see it's that perspective on what's real and what's valuable and what's true that Paul is trying to get across to them. So hopefully we can bring those things out as we're going along. Okay, so our passage today, we're in the middle of chapter 11 of 1 Corinthians. I don't know if you remember that, but we are. Starting in verse 17, I want to read the passage we're going to be looking at. We're only going to look at a part of this today. In fact, the part that most specifically talks about the Lord's Supper, we will talk about next week. But let me read you the passage, and we'll get started on making some headway in this. 11:17. But in giving this instruction, I do not praise you, because you come together not for the better, but for the worse. For in the first place, when you come together as a church, I hear that divisions exist among you, and in part I believe it. For there must also be factions among you, in order that those who are approved may have become evident among you. Therefore, when you meet together, it is not to eat the Lord's Supper. For in your eating, each one takes his own supper first, and one is hungry, and another is drunk. What? Do you not have houses in which to eat and drink? Or do you despise the church of God, and shame those who have nothing? What shall I say to you? Shall I praise you? In this I will not praise you. For I received from the Lord that which I also delivered to you, that the Lord Jesus, in the night in which he was betrayed, took bread. And when he had given thanks, he broke it and said, "This is my body, which is for you. Do this in remembrance of me." In the same way, he took the cup also after supper, saying, "This cup is the new covenant in my blood. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me." For as often as you eat this bread and drink the cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes. Therefore, whoever eats the bread or drinks the cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner shall be guilty of the body and blood of the Lord. But let a man examine himself, and so let him eat of the bread and drink of the cup. For he who eats and drinks judgment to himself, if he does not judge the body rightly. For this reason many among you are weak and sick, and a number sleep. But if we judged ourselves rightly, we should not be judged. But when we are judged, we are disciplined by the Lord, in order that we may not be condemned along with the world. So then, my brethren, when you come together to eat, wait for one another. If anyone is hungry, let him eat at home, so that you may not come together for judgment. And the remaining matters I shall arrange when I come. So, what in the end is at stake in this passage? I want to make a couple of perspective comments before we get into the details. Perhaps you're familiar with some approaches to this passage where some would emphasize the sacramental nature of the Lord's Supper. And the key problem here is that this holy ritual is being profaned by the Corinthians. It's one thing to sin in your everyday life. That's not a good thing. But if you come to a sacred ritual like the Lord's Supper and you mess up there, now you're doing something bad. Now you're doing something that you really need to watch out for. This is a sacred ritual and you had better get it right. And so some teaching on this passage would see that that's the emphasis in Paul's thinking. Look, this needs to be done right and you guys aren't doing it right. Now, you may have noticed there's language in here about the have-nots, those who do not have. And so some would emphasize the social justice aspect of this passage, that there are rich people who are mistreating poor people in this context. And the most important thing is that we achieve socioeconomic justice, that there is no instance of any poor person having any less or being treated any differently than any rich person. And so the key teaching here, the idea that we have to concentrate on, is we need to promote socioeconomic justice. Well, both of those ideas have an element of truth to them, but I think ultimately they are missing the point. I would argue that most of the time, maybe all of the time, in the exhortations that we find in the New Testament, the issue comes down to how am I, as an individual, relating to the truth about myself, about God, about my neighbor? Am I accepting it? Am I believing the truth and willing to face the implications of that truth in the way I live? Or am I ultimately blowing it off and pursuing something else? I would argue that it is not the sacrament per se that is the key issue. It is not social justice for the poor, per se, that is the key issue. It is my heart and what I believe as I interact with the Lord's Supper and with the poor. So, I don't know if this is a good example, but let me illustrate the kind of thing I mean. Suppose I were a guest at a Passover meal, and I don't know how the ritual goes at that particular event, so at certain points I do things that don't fit. I'm not supposed to eat that yet, and I eat it, and so, oh no, I'm sorry, I wasn't supposed to do that. Okay, you can imagine that my hosts might look at that and just sort of, you know, kindly say, well, that's all right, you know, you're welcome, yeah, I know you don't know what's going on. But if at this Passover meal I was to pull out a swastika and start singing the praises of Adolf Hitler or something like that, you can imagine that the response to what I did would not be, no, that doesn't belong in the ritual. The ritual doesn't have that part. No, their response would be a horror at what I was communicating about myself and my values, what it is I believed, what sort of a person I was. So it's not just that I transgressed against the ritual, but I did it in such a way that I actually was communicating something that was quite at odds with what the ritual was supposed to be about. Something very important to the life of the Jewish people, I come in and communicate my disdain for the Jewish people. Now, the problem then is not that I have profaned the ritual out there so much as I have revealed something about myself that is ugly and inappropriate. Well, that's what I'm saying here. The way that some of the Corinthians are conducting themselves when it comes to their getting together and having the Lord's Supper is saying something about their values and their perspective that is scary and inappropriate. I mean, profoundly inappropriate for what it is they are supposedly doing. They are communicating, in essence, that their own values and perspectives are the opposite of what they are saying their values and perspectives are in doing the ritual at all. Now, let me just clarify one thing at this spot. It's always difficult to find this balance when we talk about this. I don't want you to understand me to be saying that Christianity is so individualistic that it's all about me. It's not about my God and how I relate to Him. It's not about my neighbor and how I relate to my neighbor. It's just about me. Well, yes and no. What matters is that I am a person who is coming to care about how I relate to the God who is out there and to my neighbor who is out there. It's not that how I treat my neighbor is irrelevant. It's not that how I respond to God and the things of God is irrelevant. It's very relevant, but not for its own sake. And what I mean is, suppose I were the sort of person who did all of the rituals right. Paul looked at me, I lived in Corinth, and I don't do this thing that he doesn't like, whatever it is. I just go and I do the Lord's Supper, and you'd never think there was any problem with me because I'm just doing the little Lord's Supper and I'm not causing any trouble. And suppose that all of the poor are being fed, and I'm contributing to that, and I'm in favor of that, and the poor people in my group, they're doing fine because I'm contributing to them and everything's great. Would that mean then somehow that I am okay, that I'm in the place where I ought to be? And I would argue no, because Paul's concern is not primarily results-oriented. It's not, you want to make sure that the poor are fed and that God's rituals are done right, and then everything will be okay. The problem is not that the ritual so much is not being done right, or that the poor are not being treated the way they ought to, but that you are showing yourselves to be the kinds of people who don't care. You're showing yourselves to be the kind of people who don't value what God sees as valuable, that you don't believe the things that you're supposedly celebrating in the Lord's Supper, and that you have an arrogance and self-preoccupation that is entirely at odds with what the humility of being a believer in the gospel is supposed to be about. So, yes, to have a genuine change of heart towards the truth about things will have an impact on how I relate to the things of God. It will have an impact on the way I relate to you. But the important issue starts here. What do I think? What do I embrace as true? And that's what Paul is concerned about. Because ultimately, group dynamics all have to start with the choice of individuals. Each person in the group has to decide, what am I about in the midst of all of this stuff? And that's what Paul is trying to confront them with. Now, I know that some would disagree with me about that, but I want you to understand, from my perspective, that is what's at stake in a passage like this. Okay, so let's start into it. He says in verse 17, "But in giving this instruction, I do not praise you, because you gather together not for the better, but for the worse." When he says, "I don't praise you" here, this is because earlier he has been saying, "I'm happy with the fact that I have certain traditions and instructions that I've passed on to you, and you guys have been trying to follow them. And that's good. I'm glad that you've taken me seriously and that you have done things among you when you get together the way I said that I thought you ought to do them." So, in the midst of the many problems that Paul has with the Corinthians, one small word of praise he's had for them is, okay, you guys have paid attention to me and you do things the way I said to do them. But now in what I'm about to talk about, I was just talking about women and head coverings and that stuff, and, you know, you guys, you're trying to do the right thing there, and you've done things the way I told you, and that's cool, that's good. But now, in what I'm about to talk about now, I can't praise you in this. Because even though you're doing what I told you to do in celebrating the Lord's Supper together, in fact, your getting together is not for the better, but for the worse. You would think that coming together to celebrate the Lord's Supper, what we call the Lord's Supper, would be a good thing to do. It would be better to do that than not to do that. We ought to, when we get together to do that, that's a superior, we're better off having done that. Paul's saying, no, you're getting together to do it. It's such a travesty what you guys are doing, even though I told you to do it, that you're not getting together for the better, it's for the worse. You're worse off doing the Lord's Supper than you would be if you skipped it altogether. You would be better off if you just didn't do it. Because what you're doing is such a travesty that you're just making things worse. Just admit that you don't really want to have much to do with each other and skip the whole thing, then get together and do this abomination that you're doing now. So we can see a little bit here that for Paul, it's not just the ritual. The fact that they're doing it is not particularly pleasing to him. He thinks it'd be better if they didn't do it, if they're going to do it the way they are. Okay, for in the first place, when you gather together in the assembly, I hear that divisions exist among you, and in part I believe it. Okay, now if you remember back earlier in 1 Corinthians, this is not the first place where this topic of divisions has come up. Before, we saw that there were those in the church who basically rejected Paul as an apostle. They were impressed with Apollos. They thought Apollos was a very impressive speaker. And one of the problems with Paul is that evidently he was not an impressive speaker. Not in the way they thought of it. He wasn't the kind of powerful debater that everyone went away going, wow, he really blew that guy away. Wasn't he impressive? And it may have something to do as well with what Paul talked about and what Apollos talked about. The sort of thing that Apollos talked about seemed to be more acceptable to some of those in Corinth than Paul's message of the cross and sin and all of that. Not that Apollos was teaching something different, but that his strengths were more attractive than Paul's strengths were to them. Okay, so we had these divisions, basically parties growing up where people would say, well, we don't associate with Paul, but we think Apollos is cool. And others saying, no, we think Paul's the guy, and so on. The divisions here seem to be along different lines than those explicitly argued in the earlier chapters in 1 Corinthians. The divisions here seem to be along class and economic lines. And we see that language about those who do not have. We'll spell that out as we go along. I don't know. At this point, it's hard to know ultimately. It may be that the same groups are sort of involved in this. That is, that it would not be hard to imagine that those who put a high premium on what the Greeks would consider to be wisdom, and those who were therefore very socially acceptable because of their wisdom and the way people would admire their skill at refuting their opponents and that sort of thing, it's not at all impossible that that group would have tended to be the upper class in the community. And so it's possible that those who saw themselves as Paul's enemies were also socially distinct from the other group, and even from Paul, because Paul would not have been an upper class person himself. But I don't know, and we don't really know. In the first chapters, Paul is referring to the grounds on which they're dividing up, and there the issue is, who do we prefer as a teacher? Here, the divisions that are happening seem to be along the lines of the haves and the have-nots. And that may, if you were there living in that group, that may translate into the same groups. I'm not sure. He has this strange phrase that he uses, and in part I believe it. I hear about these divisions among you, and in part I believe it. Partly this depends on how we take the next sentence, which I'll talk about in a minute here. It's possible that Paul means something like this. If we were to paraphrase, step back and say, well, okay, I hear these reports. Do I believe them? Well, at least some of it I believe. I admit maybe some of it is exaggeration or hearsay or something like that, but at least part of it seems plausible to me. And maybe that's what he means. I'm not sure. I have always read this phrase, and I still cannot convince myself that this is not true. I hear him saying something like this. I hear that there are divisions among you, and up to a point I find it easy to believe. He's saying, in a certain sense, I find it plausible that there are divisions among you. And I don't know if that ultimately is what he means by the phrase, but it works for me in the context. I can see what he would be doing if that's what he means, because of how I understand what he goes on to say here. He says, for indeed it is necessary for there to be factions among you in order that those who are approved might become evident among you. Okay. Now, I want to talk about this verse for a little bit, because I think it's very interesting and significant. Many commentators struggle with this verse because in the first part of the letter, Paul is very clear that, you know, these divisions among you, this is bad, we shouldn't be having these divisions. And here, in the section we're looking at, he also is going to be down on the divisions among them. This is not a good thing. So, how can Paul say it is necessary for there to be factions among you? It sounds like he's giving in and saying, yeah, it's inevitable that this is going to be the case. How can he be saying that when he's writing to them to tell them not to do this sort of thing? And because various commentators are so convinced that he couldn't be saying anything that acknowledges the inevitability of divisions in a letter where he's urging them not to be divided, that we come up with various strategies to try to explain away what it sounds like he's saying here. Maybe he's being sarcastic. We understand approved, those who are approved is to be those who are the upper class, those who are the the good guys or something, and he's saying, oh yeah, there have to be factions among you so that the really cool people can shine. You know, yeah, that's what has to be. So you say something sarcastic like that, and of course he doesn't mean it. See, the key is these commentators are looking for a way to take the verse so that it's not saying what it sounds like it's saying. And I mean, I have to admit, I do that sometimes, so that's fair, but that's one of the strategies I'm aware of. Another strategy is to say, well, we know at certain points in Paul's letter, and I would agree about this, at certain points when he says something, he is quoting what the Corinthians have said to him. So maybe this is one of those deals. And he's saying something like, you know, I know that you would say that divisions are inevitable because that's how those who are approved, that's how the true believers become known. So, you know, we admit that, you know, when we do the Lord's Supper, there's kind of these divisions. But, you know, wouldn't you agree, Paul, that's just kind of a necessary thing? And then Paul's going to come along and say, no, doesn't have to be. But in spite of those and other options that I have seen, after looking at this question again, although I'm willing to be convinced otherwise, I am still convinced that Paul means what he says here, and that there is no contradiction between what he's trying to accomplish in this section and what he says here about the inevitability of divisions. Partly, we have to understand how Paul sees the idea of unity, why unity is important, and what he's shooting for. And this brings us back as a little bit of a review of what he's been saying in the earlier parts of 1 Corinthians. When he chastises them for the divisions that they have come into, I am of Paul, I am of Apollos, and so on, when we looked at what his argument was, it is not just, look, divisions are bad, I don't care what it takes, you all need to be getting together and be unified. I don't care what you have to sacrifice. I don't care how you need to accommodate each other. I don't know what truths you need to jettison in the process. You just need to make sure that you get together and you're all one when you get together. Rather, I argued that Paul's concern was what you need to do is believe the truth of the gospel, and so unite yourselves around that truth. The divisions among you are arising from the fact that you have values and beliefs that are out of step with the gospel. And because of that, you are separating on grounds that are foolish and worldly. What you need to do is repent. Believe the gospel again. Believe what the gospel has to say about your life and what is true and what is valuable. And then you will find yourselves united because you have joined together in a common perspective about what's true and important. When the Corinthians were saying, I am of Paul and I am of Apollos, they were doing it for a reason. Many of them had rejected Paul as an unimpressive speaker. He's like a hick. You know, I'm embarrassed by him. He comes around. I can't bring my important friends around to hear Paul because he's just always talking about the cross and sin and all that kind of stuff. That's embarrassing. I mean, now I could take him to see Apollos because Apollos rocks. I mean, you know, we go away and say, boy, he's impressive. But Paul is embarrassing. They cared more about the respectability of human wisdom than they cared about the truth of the gospel. But what's the cure for such divisions? Some of the members of the church believe that the gospel is embarrassing and that Paul is not a true apostle. So shall the rest of the church say, okay, that's fine. Why don't you just go ahead and believe that Paul isn't an apostle and that the gospel is embarrassing, but we'll all be united together. We won't bring up any of those embarrassing disagreements we have about Paul and the gospel and that stuff. We'll just be together. No. Paul is clear in what he wants them to do is to unite around the truth. What he wants is those who are embarrassed by the gospel to stop being embarrassed by the gospel. That's what he wants. And when that happens, then they will stop being parties who have aligned themselves with various teachers for various reasons, and they will recognize that they are in this together as fellow believers in the one gospel following the one Lord Jesus Christ. So, to Paul, a church is not a group of people who must unite at all costs. A church is a group of people made up of individuals, each of whom must make the individual choice to admit the truth about themselves as sinners, to see God as merciful and forgiving, to believe his offer of mercy, to look for the hope of eternal life, to pursue what is good, and so on. As each one chooses to embrace the truth, then unity will develop. Now, is it a dead certainty that everyone in Corinth will hear Paul's words, repent, and truly embrace the gospel, and so they will be totally and perfectly united? No, I don't think so. Paul is calling them to this, but some of his opponents are pretty committed. If you look, the move from 1 Corinthians to 2 Corinthians, 2 Corinthians in places gets more stern than 1 Corinthians was, because the problem is getting worse. Paul believes in a difference between the children of God and the rest of the world. Those in whom God is at work are going to ultimately see the truth. Their lives are going to reflect a certain humility, a certain willingness to admit that they are sinners, a certain recognition that what's important in life is what the gospel offers us, and so a recognition that we together, who have embraced that gospel, share something together important. But there are also those whose hearts are closed to those truths, and some of those people are in congregations of Christians. They're there for their own reasons, and ultimately, those truths about their own sinfulness, what is truly valuable in life, and all of those are not the things that are ultimately driving them. Over time, as God takes people through various trials and circumstances, as we mature as believers, those who are committed to the gospel from inside will become known. The distinction will become apparent. It can't help but be apparent, ultimately. I think that's what Paul is talking about in this verse. He uses the phrase, those who are approved. And that word, approved, and its related words, is very important in the New Testament. We're talking about those whose faith has been tested, that who have had the chance to actually confront the reality of the gospel in some way, and you start to see the reality that they in fact actually do believe this, that it is something for them personally. And the theme of having our faith tested through trials and maturing through that process is a big one. So I think what Paul is getting at here is something like this. It doesn't surprise me that there are factions among you. Sooner or later, those whose faith has shown itself will be seen as distinct from the rest. Now, I don't want you to misunderstand me. I'm not saying that the true believers pull back and distance themselves from the rest. I only associate with the pure. I don't hang around with anybody that hasn't shown themselves to be as marvelously faithful as I am. That's not what he's getting at all. In fact, the situation into which Paul is writing is just the opposite. In fact, the divisions that are coming up in the midst of the Lord's Supper are arising from those who have separated themselves, I would argue, who see themselves as superior, who see themselves as socially and economically superior from others. And so the divisions have arisen because the worldly values of some have separated them from the more believing and faithful values of others. The ones who are approved, the believers, are not the ones who have separated themselves here and caused divisions, but the divisions are inevitable ultimately because there is a conflict of values. So I think Paul's words are very serious here, and they implicitly make a strong rebuke. I can believe that there are factions among you, because I would expect that the worldly and foolish among you would ultimately show themselves to be different from those whose faith has shown to be real. Sooner or later, in the midst of living as believers together, we're going to confront the issue of whether this stuff is real to us, whether we actually believe it. Because as we interact with each other, we're difficult to get along with. There are differences between us that tend to separate human beings. There are people whose personality is aggravating to me. There's people who find my personality aggravating. There are social differences. There are class differences, even in a society like ours. They can happen. People who have more money, less money, more position, better jobs, all of that. There are age differences. All of those things we face as a reality that, given all things being equal, we tend to like to associate with people who are like ourselves. One of the things that we confront in the gospel is this truth that believers, those in whom God is at work, those who find forgiveness from God and who are looking forward to the ultimate fulfillment of their lives in the kingdom of God, have something in common together that is more important, is more fundamental than the things that divide us. This is a theme that we have been finding throughout 1 Corinthians. You may remember I've talked about it before because I think we've seen it in the letter. But how can that fundamental binding reality actually bind us unless we actually believe it? If the reality of the gospel, if the reality of my own need to be forgiven by God, if the reality of God's faithfulness and mercy in forgiving me, if my need to be rescued from sin and death and futility, if all of that hasn't really come home to me yet as the truth of my life, the truth of the reality that I have to face, then what is going to actually prevail as I'm interacting with you is, well, I find you attractive to be around, and I don't find you attractive to be around. In theory, yes, we're all in this together, but since the hope of the gospel is only a theory to me, it's only a theory as I interact with you. And what will prevail ultimately then is I'm going to seek my own self-interest and find those that I think can give me what I want and ignore those that I don't think are going to give me what I want. So I think that's the idea that Paul is getting at here, is that, look, ultimately the truths of the gospel are going to work as a kind of filter. There are going to be those who, in the struggles of their life, grow into the beliefs of the gospel as the operating principle out of which they live, and there will be those who do not grow into that and ultimately find something else, some other set of values and beliefs by which to operate. Even though both of you may be saying, well, we believe in Jesus. I think what Paul is getting at is that is an inevitable process. And there's no guarantee that everyone is going to make the decision in the same direction. Therefore, to a certain extent, there's always the possibility that there will be irreconcilable differences. Because in order to reconcile the differences, everyone would have to have the same set of fundamental values. And it just may not happen. And in fact, in what Paul's calling them to here, I don't think Paul would be happy if the offenders in this particular case recognized, okay, we're being chewed out by Paul, so we'll do the Lord's Supper different now, and kept their attitudes towards the gospel and the rest of the people in the church the same. It's not the fact that there are divisions that's of concern to Paul. It is, look, you are facing a choice as to what you think is true, what you think is important, what you think is valuable. What's the problem that has developed? Paul says, for when you eat, each one goes ahead with his own meal, and one is hungry and another is drunk. So we start to get into the specifics of the problem here. What is it that's so bad? He says, well, one is drunk. Maybe, is it people are getting drunk? Is he saying that's inappropriate for you to be getting drunk at the Lord's Supper? Well, I think it would be inappropriate to be getting drunk at the Lord's Supper, but I don't think that's at the heart of the problem. That's not really what he's concerned about, I don't think. These days, almost any commentary on this section that you would read will point out some archaeological evidence that we have to go on. And I don't know how relevant this is to the situation. It is possibly relevant. Most of the commentators are quite convinced that this is the key factor, but I don't know. But you have to picture, you know, they don't have a church that they're going to. They're meeting in people's homes. And if it's a large group of people who are meeting in someone's homes, it has to be a fairly wealthy individual who's going to be hosting them. Some people don't live in the kinds of houses where everybody in the church could come and congregate. So in a fairly wealthy home, you would have an atrium, a courtyard as you went in with a fountain in the middle. And that area there, you could get, they said, what I read, was like 30 to 50 people in that area. But there is a dining room off the courtyard where you would only be able to get like, I don't know, 9 or 10 people maybe in that dining room. Culturally speaking, what we understand would have happened generally in a person like that hosting people in their home is that in the dining room is where the close friends, the wealthy, the upper echelon people that you most valued would eat with you in the dining room. And out in the atrium is where everybody else would be, the servants and freedmen and so on, hangers-on, people that were invited but are just not quite, you know, with the high group. And it is my understanding that it was common for, if you're going to have a meal like that, that people would bring their own food. So what kind of food you bring depends on your particular status. And I think it's important for us to understand that they didn't have as much to work with as we do these days. Even those who don't have a lot of money in our society, most people, through various circumstances, have access to a fair amount of food. But in this situation, you would have had quite a separation between those who would have had more than enough for themselves and those who didn't have much. So all of that may possibly contribute to the background here. It's a little bit hard to say. I don't know whether, in fact, what was happening is that the wealthy host had his wealthy friends in the dining room and kind of shut everybody else out. It's possible that that was part of what was going on. I don't know. What we do know is the evidence that we have here in the text. We have this language, each one goes ahead or takes beforehand his own meal. He says, one is hungry and another is drunk. He uses the language, you put to shame those who do not have. At the end, he encourages them to wait for one another. And he concludes with, if anyone is hungry, let him eat at home. Okay, so that's kind of, those are the little pieces that we have to try to understand what is the problem, what was going on here. You look at that language, some of you are taking beforehand, and you need to wait for one another. It sounds like the problem might be, well, some people are getting there and they're going ahead and they're eating first and they're not waiting for everybody else to show up so that everybody can eat together. Which, if that's all we had, I suppose that might sound plausible, although that doesn't seem like a huge problem, but it certainly doesn't foster togetherness, so Okay, he's saying, yeah, you're going to, before everybody starts eating, wait for everybody to show up so that you can all eat together. But I don't think that's the problem. Because remember this language, putting to shame those who do not have. So it seems to be a bigger, more fundamental issue. I think what something like this must be what's going on. That you have those who do have, those who have an abundance, are going ahead. In essence, they're treating this as the way they would treat a typical meal where they're hosting people. They've come over and my rich friends are going to get together and we're going to have a big blowout. We're going to have a banquet and we're really going to feast on, you know, we're going to have lots to drink and lots to eat. And so you have this situation where on the one hand, you have some people in the church who are at this meal and they're going hungry because they brought what little they have and they don't have much. And so they're pretty much doing without. Whereas those who have a lot, they're saying, hey, this is great. And they're having a banquet over here with their equally wealthy friends. And so what you have, in essence, is this division where there's a party going on with people feasting and eating and drinking and getting drunk. The problem with the drunkenness is not so much they're getting drunk, but the fact is they obviously have so much that they can get drunk on it. I mean, here's someone over here who barely has anything, and yet this group over here has so much that they can get drunk. I mean, they're going for it. Now, the language about wait for one another, that's a little trickier. I think, given the fact that their conduct is shaming those who do not have, that it has to be more than just, it's not wait for everybody to show up before you start eating. That somehow what they are not acknowledging, they are not recognizing the situation that there are those among them that do not have. They're going ahead and eating without recognizing that there are others among them that don't have much to eat at all. So when he talks about them waiting for each other, there are several possibilities for how we would understand what he has in mind. If I'm vaguely remembering, Jack can tell me afterwards whether I'm wrong. I have this vague recollection that Jack has argued that we would take the word more like waiting on each other. Is that the idea being that if you think about where we get the word waiter, a waiter is someone who waits. That is, if I'm not the waiter, I go ahead and eat. I attend to my own eating. But if I'm a waiter, I am with waiting. I am not eating right now, but I am waiting on you to eat. I am attending to your needs before I attend to mine. It's kind of like that story that Jesus tells about, you know, when your servant comes in, you don't say, oh, that's a great job, now you sit down here and eat. You say, no, you wait on me. I mean, that's your job. You take care of me. So one way of understanding it would be that what he's saying is, instead of bringing your big feast and going ahead and pigging out and ignoring the fact that there are others among you that have nothing, you should be waiting on one another. That is, hold off and make sure, before you consume your big feast, make sure that everybody has something and that you, if they don't, you take some of what you have and share it with them. That's why he would say, then, if anyone is hungry, let him eat at home. What he's saying is, if your primary preoccupation is to make sure that you get yourself stuffed at this, well, a ceremony that is supposed to celebrate what you share in common is not a great place to stuff yourself and ignore the fact that other people don't have stuff. You know, eat something at home and then come prepared to share with the rest here. Make this a thing where we are in this together. I think it's something like that is at stake. It is not just don't eat before the other person does in time. You know, don't wait and make sure that everybody's there before you start. It's wait on each other, look to see that everyone has something, take some of what you have and share it, so that ultimately this ceremony becomes something that is about your togetherness and what it is you share. Okay, so I think this then helps us to see what the situation is into which now Paul is about to start talking about the Lord's Supper. He's going to remind us what it is that Jesus instituted, what did he say, and what it was about. It is in understanding what the Lord's Supper is about that we will recognize why it is so inappropriate that they are conducting themselves the way they are. But I want to talk about that next week. Today, the points that I wanted to bring out are, first of all, Paul's statement that there is a sense in which there is always going to be a kind of division, that the approved are always ultimately going to show themselves to be different than those who do not share those values. And I think that is something that is important for us to understand. There is a time when it is appropriate to compromise, to recognize we don't all believe the same things, but we believe fundamentally, essentially, the same things about the gospel. And so we tolerate those differences of perspective and we don't make a big deal about them. But Paul is equally convinced that the fundamental truths of the gospel are something that we cannot compromise on, that I have to live my life in the light of those things, and ultimately if that separates me from those who will not live in the light of those things, then that's inevitable. That's something that is going to have to happen. Because you can't compromise the gospel itself for the sake of having unity. And then the other thing that we want to understand from this is that in this particular situation, the way that they are conducting themselves, we'll see this more next time, but this choice to take this social interaction, we're going to get together as a church, but we're going to treat it as an opportunity to have a banquet amongst us over here and ignore what's happening with the rest of them over there, that is a way in which the supposed commitments of the gospel are being betrayed by the actuality of how they're living. That the values that they're showing in being so willing to ignore those who are in a socially different place than they are. Because I think that's kind of the key here, is that the fact that supposedly we're getting together as a church together to celebrate what we have in common, that's less important than the fact that, after all, I am one of the important people and you're not one of the important people, and so I need to hang around with my own. That what Paul's concerned about is not just that the poor people in the church get treated better, but that everyone in the church recognize that kind of conduct is evidence of an entirely different set of beliefs and values than what the gospel is calling us to. Now, it's next week that we'll be able to see more specifically how it is incongruous. But I hope that at least what we can see here is Paul's concern is neither primarily with making sure the poor get fed or primarily with the fact that the ritual not be violated, but that there is this incongruity between what the ritual is supposed to be about and the values and beliefs that are actually being shown in the midst of it. And we'll talk about that more next time. Well, I didn't leave any time for questions. It wasn't on purpose. It was just my typical running off at the mouth. If you had a burning question, we might have time, just a couple of minutes, but we do want to let the kids out before they overrun their keepers. And anything you'd like to ask about or say here, Logan does.
Could you touch again on how elaborate or ceremonial that supper was?
I think it would be better for me to talk about that next week.
Okay.
That will come out. I mean, I'm going to talk about that. So that was an easy question. Anybody else have any questions I can ignore? I have time to ignore a lot of questions if you have them.
I have a question on the word approved, mm-hmm. because I had seen that as being something completely different before, and maybe I was just reading it wrong. But you're taking it as approved by God. And when I read that before, I was thinking more along the lines that there were these people who were coming out that were more kind of approved by the group, like they were the more popular type of person, and that he was saying, oh, it must be that you're divided because otherwise there wouldn't be these people who you consider to be like the top people because there's this division.
And I recognize that that is possible. I'm swayed in the other direction because that word is such an important word and is used in the way that I'm taking it, this word and related words. You know, we have like James chapter 1, verse 12, where he talks about blessed are those who persevere under trial because having been approved, they will receive the crown of life and that sort of thing. That the idea is proven under test is kind of the idea. Now, so I grant you, if we were to take it as in the kind of the sort of the snottier way of understanding what approved meant, then yeah, maybe he would be chewing them out for even thinking that there are those who are approved and those who aren't. But the fact is that Paul is quite comfortable in talking about those who are approved in the sense, in a good sense. So I'm inclined to think that that's what he's getting at there. But that's a good question.
Okay,
maybe we'll let it go at that then.